So I'll follow this outline, a remind of the exacerbation, just explained well by Dr. Jovelikian, the rationale of non-invasive ventilation, then to see who fit for non-invasive ventilation, when to start it and when to say that it's a failure, how it's in the real life, is there any specific situation, what to do after finishing non-invasive ventilation in the acute setting, and new era beyond the new non-invasive ventilation. So let's start. It was well explained by Dr. Jovelikian. Acute attack is well defined by a worsening in the patient's symptoms. This can lead to change in medication and change from day-to-day symptoms. And this will be maintained for days. It can delay for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and so on. So the consequence of the exacerbation is well known. It's not a simple disease. It's so complicated. The mortality is very high. After doing one exacerbation, the mortality, half of the patients will be losing their life after 3 years. So it's very interesting for us to consider a patient who is exacerbating and how to deal with the exacerbation issue. Another issue that's well known actually is the first exacerbation. Between the first and the second exacerbation, there is a lot of time, 5 years, but the next exacerbation will be more short to appear, and at the end, after 10, for example, exacerbation, the time will be less than 4 months. So keep this in mind. Once there, the exacerbation will be repeated, and the exacerbation will be shortened and more severe. The treatment was well shown. We will be intensifying the bronchodilation, systemic steroids, oxygen, antibiotics, and surely the non-invasive ventilation, very important to consider. It's a backbone treatment to assist the ventilatory failure of our patient. So what about non-invasive ventilation? What we know about and what we learned in the last decade, in the beginning we were using these ventilators as compressors that delivers pre-setting volume, and these respirators, you all know about them, they are so heavy, they consume a lot of electricity, and they are very fixed in volume. So they are not very well adapted for a patient or a difficult patient. And then after, the turbine arrived. And the turbine is well developed now, and the turbine can be working from, can spin from 40 to 50,000 spins per hour. So it's very, very sophisticated now. It's very autonomic, and we can have a very effective flow generated by this kind of turbine, especially when it was motorized. And this is very interesting in all our new ventilators nowadays. So we are facing nowadays two kinds of non-invasive ventilator. In one side, the sophisticated non-invasive ventilator used in the hospital, especially in the intensive care. And on the other hand, for patients who are not so dependent, the non-invasive ventilator that can be delivered to the patients at home and can be so small like this one. So how to classify ventilator in our mind? We should be aware about how to deal with these ventilator in clinical practice. So they are ventilators, they are volumetric. These ventilators can deliver volume. Ventilator that can deliver pressure, the barometric receptor, The ventilator that can deliver two level of pressure, the two level pressure can be only spontaneous, we cannot fix the respiratory rate, or can be equipped with multiple other features. The fourth subgroup, the new one, the dual respirator, these are new respirators that can be working as barometric and volumetric, and it can be in the same mode even. And at the end, the fifth group, the relaxer pressure, these are not really ventilators, these can help the patients to evacuate the secretions. Other issue which is important to keep in mind, We fix the ventilator that we will be using in our patients with COPD in exacerbation. What will be the lumen, the circuit? It's a double circuit or the one mono circuit? If it's a double circuit, it will be simple. They will have one circuit for the inspiration and the other for the expiration. If we deal with a respirator with one circuit, mono circuit, we should keep in mind how it can work. There should be, first of all, or an expiratory valve, like this one, and this expiratory valve will be working in the insufflation, so the flow will go from the ventilator to the patients during the inspiration, and then after it will open and the patients will exhale. These are monocircuit ventilator and equipped with an expiratory valve. These are totally different with the monocircuit ventilators with an intentional leak, and these kind of respirator, the leakage can be on the circuit by itself, excuse me. It can be in the mask, and it can be as a valve in the circuit. Another issue to be aware that the ventilator that we'll be using can be adapted to this kind of circuit. So you will be having ventilator with intentional leaks, ventilator with expiratory valve, and ventilator with both. And we should be setting and tell the respirator what kind of circuit we'll be using with it. So every physician that will be dealing with these kind of ventilators should be aware about the technicity inside and how this respirator will be working. It's not sufficient to put the patients on BiPAP and let him go. So in summary, we'll be having patients who are not at all dependent, non-dependent patients. In the contrast, on the other pole, patients who are totally dependent and they need intensive care. So we'll be using ventilator designs for home ventilation from one side, using this kind of respirator inside the hospital, why not, to arrive to the respirator designs in the intensive care setting. Be careful. These respirators do not have a brain. You should use your brain and the brain of the patients to succeed a good non-invasive ventilation session. Having chosen the respirator, the circuit, don't forget how to do with the interface, what to choose as an interface. You should be aware that you should be having a large set of masks or interface, because every patient will get benefit or will be befitting one interface for the face of the patients. And there is novelties in this domain. We can have the Grigoretti masks. We can have the total face mask for some patients, the helmet cask, and even new cask as the integral mask. So you should be aware that these masks exist. If your patient is not doing well with your facial mask or nasobuccal mask, try to use other things, as I will be showing in a while in the new studies. Don't forget the humidification system. A lot of patients will not tolerate the non-invasive ventilation if there is no humidification system integrated inside. So this non-invasive ventilation in COPD exacerbation, why will be doing it? It's very important for us. Why? Because first of all, you know, all of you, that will be a reduction, a great reduction in the infection in the lung, but it's not only the lung issue. The reduction is also in the infection in the urinary tract and in the catheter-related infection. Why? Because the patients on non-invasive ventilation is not so dependent. It's still awake, it's still moving, and so on. So keep in mind, it's not only to reduce the comorbidities or the complication in the lung-wise, it is for all the other issues. So starting in the late 90s, first report, we did one session of non-invasive ventilation, and what we noted after stopping it, the patients continue to getting better. The CO2 continue to be reduced, and the patients is getting better and better. That's why a lot of studies were done on this domain, and the first consensus in 2002 stated it well, very well, that it is a very effective treatment in non-invasive, as a non-invasive ventilation for patients who are on a respiratory failure. And the recommendation was at that moment B, with a pH less than 7.35. So it was a new technique, a new treatment without intubating the patients and passing to invasive ventilation. And things progressed with time, and in 2009, the non-invasive ventilation was clearly in level one, so the evidence base is so high, evidence base is the most high that can be imagined for the exacerbation, but also for the facilitation of weaning patients who are intubated. So it should be as a level one. It's a fault now not to use a non-invasive ventilation for a patient in an exacerbation. More in this guidelines in 2009, we can more specify the contraindication. What was considered an absolute contraindication is now considered as relative if we know very well how to apply the technique, and the only absolute that remain is the respiratory arrest and the patients who cannot fit the mask. All the others are now relative. So in 2015, in the gold, it is well stated the indication respiratory acidosis, pH less than 7.35, but also patients who have a severe dyspnea with the clinical signs of respiratory muscle fatigue, or both. So this will decrease mortality, well proven, a lot of study, decrease the need of intubation. So we can have three types of patients, patients who have less than 7.35. These patients will get a great benefit, and this NIV is well advised. Patients who will be who have a pH less than 7.3, 50% of these patients will deteriorate if we do not apply non-invasive ventilation, and they can arrive to be intubated. And even patients who have a pH less than 7.2, it is strongly advised, because even if it's applied, still 50% of patients that will likely be using endotracheal intubation. So when to consider that the non-invasive ventilation applied had failed? Keep in mind that after failing a non-invasive ventilation, till now we need to intubate our patients. So we should keep in mind a timetable clear that the failure should be considered with time. Is it immediate, less than 1 hour? At that time, there is no discussion. We need to intubate this patient. Or it's early after starting the non-invasive ventilation, between 1 hour till 2 days. And this is very important, these early failure, because this is the time where the medical therapy should work. And we should be doing all our best to succeed these sessions of non-invasive ventilation. But if the non-invasive ventilation failed after 48 hours, it's totally an independent problem. And this problem necessitates a different approach, why the medical therapy has already had its chances. So let's have it in mind. 15% of patients will have immediate failure, so we need to intubate them directly. The early constitute more than 2/3 of the patients, and the late one, 17%, not more, in this study of 2014. So how to approach these early failure? We know very well that there is parameter that should be monitored in every patient receiving non-invasive ventilation. If the patient starts with a pH of 7.3, and if we check on him after 4 hours, his pH, and his pH succeeded to increase from 7.3 to 7.35, the risk of failure has been reduced by a half. If the patient after 4 hours succeeded to reduce his respiratory rate by 4, imagine that he was on 30 and now he's on 26 respiratory rate per minute, so we can reduce his failure by around 30%. So you can have an idea who will succeed the non-invasive ventilation and who he can proceed and continue this non-invasive ventilation starting from 4 hours in this early study in 2011. This was developed more and more, and this new study, taking account also the pH at 2 hours, the respiratory rate at 2 hours, but the level of consciousness from one side with the Glasgow scale, and the severity of the disease with the Apache scale. So at that time, after starting my first session, I'll be evaluating these four parameters, and I'll be aware if my patients will be a good candidate to succeed the ventilation, the green boxes here, or he have a lot of risk factors not to succeed the non-invasive ventilation. So to be aware what to do next. In the late non-invasive failure, it's totally another issue. Why? This is related to sleeping process. The patient is not doing well, is not sleeping well. There is a poor circadian distribution, low REM sleep. So this is a sleep deprivation issue after 2 days of acute treating. And these patients who will fail the non-invasive ventilation after two days, it's totally difficult. The treatment, the medical treatment was started and it failed. So we need to approach him with another issue. We should stop the non-invasive ventilation to pass to another things. These late failure are a big problem. Why? 2/3 of patients who fail the non-invasive ventilation after 2 days will die. 68% of deaths. And we can predict who will be in this category. The patients who have a lot of morbidities, and the patients who have not at all activities in the daily time. So these patients will not sleep well, and at that time you can imagine that these patients will do more confusion and will lose the non-invasive treatment. What about real life? It's very beautiful in theory, in studies. In real life, this is progressing. This is a study coming from the Mass General, and the rate of failure in non-invasive ventilation in the acute setting is around 30%. Another study from the UK with the best evidence for applying non-invasive ventilation, only 66% received it with a pH less than 7.26. So this means 1/3 of the patients are not getting benefit from this technique. And this is a study coming from the UK, study from 2011, so you can imagine. Patients who have a pH between 7.26 and 7.35, the indication is here, 34% are still not receiving non-invasive ventilation. So this audit done in the UK, we can understand why there is a lot of pressure now on the respiratory community to ameliorate how they should deal with these kind of patients. Another type of study, a large study also coming from more than 300 hospitals, the use of non-invasive ventilation as initial ventilatory strategy varies considerably between one hospital and the others. And this should be kept in mind when we need to have this kind of technique in our hospitals. What about the success rate with time in the real life? About the failure is maintained, about 20 to 30%, but what we can note that the severity of patients that we can deal with is more and more severe. So we are dealing now with a pH around 7.2 and succeeding the 80% of the technique. Specific situation, is it sufficient to adapt our setting, the ventilator, the circuit, the interface, and so on? In fact, these studies, these new studies in 2013, a patient who was receiving non-invasive ventilation and failed the technique and normally should be shifted to intubation and invasive ventilation was shifted to a total face mask. And with this kind of changing, we succeeded to relieve 64% of the patients. So you should not precipitate intubation when you feel that it's an early failure, it's due to the interface by itself, it's due to the scar on the nose, the skin lesion on the nose, the patient is feeling bad because he's not tolerating well his mask. Shift him to another kind of interface, more easy for him, and this study confirmed this problem. Another interesting study in 2011, very interesting, to work on flow and pressure waveform to adapt our setting. It's not sufficient to fix the IPAP, the EPAP, and go away. The patients who succeeded to have a good ventilator and we can adapt for his case the waveform of pressure and flow will have a better outcome. So there is a totally different outcome starting 2 hours after starting our non-invasive ventilation on pH, on the success of the sessions, and even on the PCO2. Another interesting point, it's well admitted nowadays, to use and to have this specimen easily for patients in acute exacerbation, presenting for a pneumonia, for example, to have to perform a fibro optic bronchoscopy with non-invasive ventilation. I mean to pass inside the non-invasive ventilation, and this is not a risky procedure if we are well trained to do it. What to do? After the non-invasive ventilation sessions, the patient's passed the exacerbation, but he is still hypercapnic. What to do about him? Normally, a lot of study and not a lot of controversial study, good results or no results. This is one of the biggest study. There was no difference if we continue the non-invasive ventilation after the acute exacerbation. So it was not admitted. I showed one of these studies in 2014. But what we learned new in the literature is this study that I wanted to share it with you, a new study coming from Germany, in fact, when they insisted for this category of patients who are still hypercapnic after the acute exacerbation, they tried to use the non-invasive ventilation in a different setting. They tried to achieve a PCO2 lesser than 20% from the start, from the beginning, or to normalize the capnia. With this kind of setting, so it's a high intensity ventilation, they are insisting on adherence. So it was a prospective study, and look for the results. For the first time, these patients who are still hypercapnic after an exacerbation, and these patients are now stable but still hypercapnic, there is a huge amount of difference in mortality. The outcome here was with the mortality. And this is very interesting for us. The mortality was reduced from 33% to 12%. So if ever we want to continue the non-invasive ventilation after the acute setting, try to have clear target to reduce your PCO2 to normal or to 20% less from the beginning. And at that time, it will be called a high-intensity non-invasive ventilation. What's beyond? Imagine that the patients fail the non-invasive ventilation. Normally, we intubate them. Now we have this new technique, the non-invasive ventilation with respiratory dialysis. We learned a lot of about ECMO and the complication of ECMO. And we know a lot the complication of ECMO was due to the large catheter we were using. The large catheter, the problem was bleeding with the coagulation issue and the problem of the high flow. This technique is a kind of ECMO, but it is a small ECMO, if you want. This is the removal, the extracorporeal removal of CO2. It seems that CO2 removal is more simple than assuring the oxygen. So the oxygen is still be assured by the lungs, but the CO2 will be removed with the catheter and the device applied to the patients. It can use a lot of technique. It can be using infusion of acids to the patients. The acids can be hydrochloric acids or even lactic acids or even electrodialysis without any infusion. So this is a kind of ECMO, but it's a low flow, 0.5 liter per minute compared to more than 2 liters with the ECMO. It can be intermediate. So partial removal of CO2 till 40%, and we can totally remove all the CO2 if we are dealing with an intermediate flow. And how to place it in the non-invasive ventilation setting? It's well documented not to use it from the beginning, but if the patient, after 2 hours, failed the non-invasive ventilation, normally we should intubate him. If we can not intubate him directly, immediately, we can start him on ECHO, extracorporeal CO2 removal, and at that time we can maintain this patient. Very interesting approach, and this is the first approach published in 2012, where we succeeded to avoid invasive ventilation when we used both technique, non-invasive ventilation with respiratory dialysis. And this is a study, a newly published study, about associating for patients who are not responding anymore on non-invasive ventilation. They were randomized, they were matched with the patients intubated, and we know very well that these 30% of failure are gained again, the non-invasive ventilation without going to invasive ventilation. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Moussa, for having clarified a very complicated issue. Any question in the room? Jocelyne?
Merci, Moussa, pour cette belle présentation. Ma question, c'est pour les patients en fait, qui ne sont pas en insuffisance respiratoire aiguë et qui sont hypercapniques, qui sont relativement stables, je veux dire, des BPCO sévères avec une PCO2 qui est supérieure à 45. Comment tu poses l'indication de la ventilation non-invasive?
Donc là, on parle de la ventilation non-invasive chez les malades BPCO stables hypercapniques. Donc l'approche, elle est totalement différente. Il y a beaucoup d'études qui sont favorables, d'autres études qui sont pas positives. Et donc moi, j'approche les choses de la manière suivante. Si j'ai un patient qui a expérimenté la ventilation non-invasive et il l'a bien tolérée, il maintient une CO2 au-delà de 55, et donc chez ces malades, ce sous-groupe de malades pourra être ventilé en non-invasif, en chronique, à condition de s'assurer à chaque fois qu'il tolère bien et qu'on a une amélioration au moins des signes cliniques et de manière objective. Donc je maintiens un petit sous-groupe, très probablement ce petit sous-groupe pourrait bénéficier de la ventilation non-invasive, mais c'est totalement les malades qui ne sont pas du tout en état d'exacerbation. Tandis que dans l'exacerbation, il ne faut pas le rater, il ne faut pas essayer de les intuber. C'est dommage d'intuber encore à nos jours les malades avec une exacerbation qui est responsable de l'insuffisance respiratoire.
Quels sont les besoins pour mener une ventilation non-invasive efficace, les besoins en humains et au niveau de l'environnement?
C'est une question très intéressante. Pourquoi? Parce qu'on croit que la ventilation non-invasive est plus simple que la ventilation invasive. Au contraire, elle nécessite une mobilisation du médecin, de l'équipe soignante, qu'il y ait un staff qui est bien expérimenté, qui gère le malade. Vous savez tous que quand on décide d'intuber un malade, on l'intube, on sort de la chambre. Ici, c'est totalement différent. Quand on décide de débuter une ventilation non-invasive pour le même degré de sévérité, les malades doivent être mieux surveillés, monitorisés. Donc, on doit avoir plusieurs personnes, au moins 3 personnes, entre médecin, inhalothérapeute et l'infirmière pour réussir une bonne ventilation non-invasive. Merci.